It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. This week, we'll try to bring some glamour back to the humble root vegetables.
But first, Wisconsin's Democratic candidate for governor, Mary Burke, unveiled the first ad of her campaign. Let's take a listen.
Mary Burke. Today, 930 people work at Trek, the great Wisconsin company she helped build. And when she was Commerce Secretary, there were 72,000 more jobs than today. So why is Scott Walker's RGA spending $1 million attacking her? Under Walker, unemployment's up, job prospects are down to 45th in the nation, and the layoffs continue. There's a better way. A strong economy starts with a strong middle class, and that's what Mary Burke's working on every day.
Governor Walker was quick to respond with a counter ad, which he called a fact check of Mary Burke's ad.
Let's fact check Mary Burke's very first TV ad. Burke says,
under Walker, unemployment's up.
Quite the contrary, Mary. When Governor Walker took office, the unemployment rate was 7.8%. Today it's 6.3, the lowest it's been since 2008. Over 100,000 more jobs. So why would you start your campaign out with a lie? The facts? Unemployment's going down under Walker. And we can't trust Mary Burke.
Barry Burden joins us now to break down the ads and whether they make a difference. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So it looks like we've got the opening salvo in the battle for the airwaves with the first Mary Burke ad and then the Scott Walker rebuttal. What do you make of this quick 1-2 punch from the Democratic candidate and Governor Walker?
You know, we just wait for that first ad to be aired by either side, and then the other, a campaign, feels obligated to respond, and suddenly we're in an arms race. So I think we're off to the races. It's only March, but we should expect these kinds of ads, this back and forth, to continue from now till November.
Is it typically that quick a turnaround? You see an ad and a response, you know, just the same day the original ad comes out?
Well, the Walker campaign was clearly prepared for this. They had done their opposition research on Mary Burke's background, had that ad or some version of it, the pieces of it ready to go, and could respond quickly. So Burke should be on the lookout. If she's willing to offer fire, she's going to get it in return pretty quickly.
Now, this was her first campaign ad, but she had been apparently responding to ads that the Republican Governors Association had been airing against her so far. Those have been airing already. What kind of difference did those ads make?
Well, you know, Burke is mostly unknown to the electorate at this point. The most recent Marquette poll showed that something like 70% of the people it interviewed didn't have a strong enough opinion about her one way or the other to say whether they viewed her favorably or unfavorably. So she really needs to get into the business of introducing herself to the electorate. She has some time to do that, but it has to happen in relatively short order. And an introductory ad like the one she aired is a way to do that. And I think the fear is that if the Walker campaign gets off the marks first, it can define her before she has an opportunity to do it.
Now, both the ads that we heard there, they focus on jobs and the economy, obviously, from very different perspectives. But will these be the predominant issues in the race?
I think they will. It's going to be about dueling statistics. That's what our campaigns have come down to. Which set of numbers would you like to present? Which set do you believe? They do point in different directions, depending on the comparisons you make and what indicator you want to look at.
Well, let's talk about a little bit the numbers that are presented in those ads. Mary Burke saying that unemployment is up under Governor Walker. Governor Walker saying not so fast and characterizing Mary Burke as someone who can't be trusted. Can you give us a sense of where these dueling numbers come from?
Yeah, the specific comparisons really matter here. In a way, Burke is responding to that first round of ads from the Walker group, the Republican Governors Association, arguing that Wisconsin lost jobs while she was Secretary of Commerce in the Doyle administration. Her ad comes back and says, actually, when I was Secretary of Commerce, unemployment was lower than it is today under Scott Walker. The Walker campaign has now come back and said, actually, unemployment was relatively high when Walker took over as governor, but it has come down while he has been in office. So I think all of them are probably technically correct, but there's just a sleight of hand going on to try to emphasize comparisons in a way that are most favorable to their side.
Are they, in a way, comparing apples and oranges, slightly different time frames?
They are. Burke is saying, look at the era in which I was in the administration and compare that to today, and things were worse off. The Walker campaign on the other side is saying, compare the first day I took office, which is what I inherited, to where we are today. things are better. And I think voters are just going to have to decide for themselves which of those comparisons seems fairest.
So in terms of ads that tend to get start, you know, lighter, and then you see more and more of them as this election season goes along, how effective are they in swaying the public?
Well, it depends which side you're on. So I think for someone like Scott Walker, the electorate has such strong feelings about him at this point. They know him. Everyone has an opinion. More ads that he runs about himself to kind of introduce himself to the electorate are probably not going to have much effect. He's going to be more effective in trying to nail down Burke as an undesirable replacement. Burke, on the other hand, is really unknown to most voters and I think has a long way to go to make a favorable impression. And so some introductory biographical ads to tout positive things about her record could really be useful. The trouble is she has this candidate on the other side who's trying to interrupt that process, and so it's going to be a tough road for her.
Now, in the recall election, there were a lot of people who credited the pro-Walker ads, and there were a lot of them, with swaying some of the way public sentiment went and ultimately the recall election. Do you think that ads like that will be used in a similar way this time around?
I don't know. You know, there's a very small segment of the electorate who is undecided about whether they like Scott Walker and would like to see him stay in office or see him removed. So really, I still think much of this is about how his opponent is defined. If she comes across as viable, credible, active, able to do things, fix things that we think are wrong today, she will have a shot. If the Walker campaign is able to undermine her message or she stumbles along the way and isn't able to do that, then I think Walker, because of the money he has, the resources and the experience he has in running two campaigns here statewide, will probably end up being victorious.
Is there such a thing as ad fatigue? I know by the end of an election campaign, pretty much everyone will say, yes, you know, we're tired of all the ads. But is it cumulative? Do we start out tired of them?
Oh, I don't think anybody likes even that first negative ad they see. it's a little bit like winter. Maybe there's a novelty of that first snowflake in November. by now, we're ready to be done with it. It doesn't take much of the stuff to make you tired. And, you know, campaign ads, people do complain about them. They turn the channel or mute the television when they're on. But they're run for a reason, and it's that they're at least somewhat effective. They're effective at getting out your voters if you're running ads for yourself. They're effective sometimes at demobilizing your opponents. If you can raise questions about the other party's nominee, you can try to just sort of discourage the enthusiasm of their supporters. And then hopefully you can actually sway some people to your side and bring them over from supporting your opponent to supporting you.
Now, the ads that we just heard, both from Governor Walker and from Mary Burke, they both had a similarity, and it was sort of your standard, it seemed to me, campaign ad with the narration, a voice with gravitas, and some facts thrown at you. There was nothing that was really unusual about them. Is that typical of the kind of ad that's most effective?
The short answer is I don't know. Those ads are a little bit of sugar, a little bit of spice. So you offer something good about yourself. There's a positive image of the candidate. There's nice music and some mention of their accomplishments in office or in the private sector. And then you offer a contrast, and the screen turns dark. The music's more ominous, and present some statistics or something negative about your opponent, and then maybe in the end come back to yourself. So you're trying to offer different things, maybe to different voters, a positive message about who you are and something to worry about in the opponent.
In terms of the tone, Scott Walker's ad seemed a little bit more chatty, a little more personal. Is that something that you think appeals to people?
Yeah, you know, every voter has different things that they care about. Walker has strong supporters and strong opponents who may not be moved regardless of new information that comes out. But there is a segment there that I think thinks about him as a person, whether he's likable, approachable, reasonable, has good judgment, all the things you'd look for in someone in public office. And that can be conveyed accurately or not in campaign advertisements. So you see even in the Burke ad, there's an image of her sort of walking through what looks like a factory in an office of some kind, and, you know, mention of her working with Trek Bicycle. So there's a message about who she is as a person that's trying to be conveyed there, just as it is in the Walker ad.
Well, as you mentioned, the Marquette poll shows that Mary Burke is lacking in statewide recognition. Are the ads enough to get her back in the game, or is it going to take something more than that?
It's going to take everything she's got. It's not an impossible task, but it's uphill. I think about a comparison we might make between her campaign and that of Ron Johnson when he first ran for U.S. Senate in 2010. at this time in the year, he was an unknown quantity. I'm not sure that he was a candidate at this point. But by May, he was suddenly a known figure. He had wrapped up the Republican nomination, and he ended up defeating a Democratic incumbent in Russ Feingold. So it's possible, if you've got the resources and a good team and a good set of advertisements, the right strategy, to be successful. You've just got to have a lot of tailwinds and not make any mistakes.
Well, Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Good talking with you.
That was Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're getting a little bit more sunshine every day, but the temperatures are still pretty cold here in Wisconsin, and none of that local produce is in season quite yet.
But we still have good old root vegetables to keep us company, so on this Food Friday, we decided to talk about some different ways to prepare them other than the classic oven roast.
Lori Skelton is with us. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies. Lori, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Let's lay our ingredients on the table first. What root vegetables are we going to talk about today?
Well, some of the recipes that we're talking about can cover just about any. You know, start with potatoes or sweet potatoes. Move on to things that aren't quite so well liked. Turnips, rutabaga, celery root, and then weird things like sunchokes. It's basically anything that's under the ground, has a lot of great nutritional value, but especially at this time of the year, a lot of us are just tired of boil it and drown it in butter, or I'd like something other than the grate, toss it with olive oil and throw it in a hot oven and roast it.
That's my standby, yeah.
Which is perfectly wonderful, because what oven roasting, and in some cases what grilling can do in the summer, is it takes that starch that's in a root vegetable and it turns it into sugar. It makes it sweet. It makes it mellow. So many people I talk to about root vegetables always bring this up, and they talk about how grounding it is, which is certainly wonderful in the midst of winter. But as much as I love winter, it's gone on a little too long. Normally at this time of the year, I'd already be out in my garden looking for the first sorrel, the first greens of spring.
And bring your snow shovel.
And I am so ready for something green and bright and lighter. So that was the inspiration behind lighter ways to work with a root vegetable.
Well, one of your starting points, when I think of turnips and parsnips, well, rutabagas I'm looking for in my pasties. But what I do with a lot of these other things is maybe throw them in a stew or a soup, and a soup was one of your starting points, right? A parsnip soup.
Which I'm sorry to say I was unable to recreate. This was something that a friend of mine came up with on his own, and I tried to do it in a day. And this is something you have to cook your vegetables low and slow. You start off by making a basic vegetable broth, then you create a separate parsnip broth, and then once you've got your two broths talking together so that it tastes rich but the texture is light, then you glaze parsnips and add that to the soup. It's something I will definitely keep trying, but it's not something you can put together, I found out, in under 24 hours. You really need a couple of days and a couple of steps to get the taste just right.
Well, one soup you did do and brought in and I tasted, it was quite good, a golden beet borscht. And that had a really summery feel. It didn't feel like a heavy, dense winter root vegetable kind of thing.
Well, you start off with golden beets. I mean, there's your bright color right there. I ended up adapting a recipe from the good old Moosewood Cookbook from the 1970s, taking golden beets, and instead of using some of the heavier things that can be used in a borscht, like cabbage and potatoes and heavier sour cream, this had cucumber and fresh dill and scallions and buttermilk instead of the sour cream. So it was lighter. I left it chunky, and you could go ahead and puree this in a blender if you wanted a smoother, more elegant presentation. But somebody actually said it looked like chunky sunshine, and it really did feel
that,
like spring today.
I think of borscht as get you through the Eastern European winter, and this felt more like, hey, it's Eastern European spring.
I actually had somebody tell me, I've eaten a lot of borscht in my life, and I've never been fond of it, but this is pretty good. This lighter version is quite nice.
And then turning away from soups, another way to go is pickling things. You brought in a couple options. How much does it take to pickle our root vegetables?
Oh, I know you guys have talked about pickling on this show before. Mm-hmm. The one pickle I brought in, you can have in under 8 hours. Quick carrot pickle. So easy. You throw a little bit of red wine or cider vinegar in a pot, heat it up with sugar, salt, and dill seed. Throw your carrots in and just let it sit. And within hours, you've got this lovely, quick little pickle. I tried something that I honestly wasn't sure I'd like, and that was rutabaga pickles, which required a little bit of extra brining time. The pickling brine for that had cider vinegar, honey, lemon juice, cumin, mustard, coriander, cayenne, and smoked paprika. And they recommend you let that sit in the refrigerator for about a week. I gave it 5 days, and it was pretty darn tasty. This was a popular thing that was in the break room today. A lot of people gave it a thumbs
up. A lot of people like the rutabaga. I'll say I like the carrots a lot. And for the rutabaga, Lori, I've loved everything else you've made. The rutabaga, maybe a little vinegary for me. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, which is, I mean, pickled things are vinegary by their nature. I do know
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So let me ask you, the carrots were a little crisper. The rutabaga had a little bit of give to it. What was the texture that you preferred?
I did prefer the crisper.
Okay.
I guess I'm a crisp pickle guy.
Okay.
And, but I didn't know it.
And there's here again, so many things that you, that we're talking about, mix and match, find the vegetable that works for you.
So that pickled rutabaga thing, could you try it? I mean, could you just do it exactly the way you did it, but sub in turnips or parsnips?
Turnips or parsnips might work with this particular pickle because of the heat, the cayenne, the smoked paprika. I don't know if I'd want to go that spicy with a carrot.
Okay.
But again, it'd be something fun to try.
You know, parsnips I like a lot. I forget about them. I kind of use them with carrots or in substitution for carrots. Any parsnip recommendations for me?
Well, one lovely thing to do with any root vegetable, and parsnips would certainly work well with this, we're missing green at this time of the year.
Oh, yeah.
And I made a simple parsley sauce where you pound a little parsley in with garlic and sea salt and peppercorns in your mortar, and then you add a little more fresh chopped parsley and scallions and lemon peel and olive oil. You can serve that on top of any root vegetable. You can try it raw. You can boil them, serve them room temperature. You can serve them warm. Again, I was really surprised. I brought in turnips and sunchokes to pair with that parsley sauce. That was the first thing to go.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I really like the parsley sauce. And you could do that. I mean, that's something that's super flexible, like you said.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, that we've kind of shied away from because it's not necessarily light, but it's still comforting. If you're not comfortable working with certain root vegetables, start off by boiling them and then mashing them in with your mashed potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
And parsnips is a great way to, you know, you lighten the mashed potatoes with parsnips. You make them sweeter. You may not need as much butter. And so that's another good way to get more root vegetables into your life. Just slowly introduce them into your mashed potatoes and see where they go.
And you mentioned celery root. Celeriac, is that the same
thing?
Celeriac.
And that's a great one to mash with potatoes.
Okay.
It's also a good one to, if you're getting adventurous, to do in a curry. And if you're going to curry a root vegetable, one other nice thing to do, especially at this time of year, if you need a little green, add some fennel bulb to it. That'll brighten it up. It's just moist enough, it's just sweet enough, and just green enough to give it a twist.
All right. Well, a lot of great ideas. More generally, do we not give our root vegetables enough love? They're not the glamour, you know, the pinups of the vegetable world for us, are they?
No, they're not. They do not have the hipster chic of kale chips. They are what get us through the winter, and they are comforting. They are a staple. And if you give them just a little bit more attention, I think they can surprise you.
All right. Well, a lot of good surprises. And by the way, out there, if you want to try something here with your root vegetables, there's a borscht recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Lori provided us with that. I think the borscht was my biggest hit of all the things you made today, Lori. That was my favorite. Any permutations that we might try on that, apart from what's in the recipe itself?
Well, if you are a fan of traditional borscht with red beets, go ahead and use them. Go ahead and, if you're going to do that, add some things that are a little more tart. You can chop up pickles and add to that. That's going to lighten, again, the texture, give it a little bit of a different feel to it. Other traditional accompaniments with borscht are those potatoes and hard-boiled eggs.
Oh, yeah, that would be perfect.
So if you wanted to make your borscht a little bit more of a meal, go ahead and add some protein to it.
I might try doing it that way. Lori, thank you so much for joining us again.
Absolutely.
That was our own Lori Skelton, a WPR in-house foodie. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tomorrow is International Women's Day, and our guest is asking the U.S. government to take more action on violence against women around the world.
First, we get lots of feedback in our lives from friends, family, teachers, bosses, coworkers, complete strangers even. But what do we do with it? How do we react, take in the useful stuff, and not get defensive about the criticism?
Our next guests have some answers to those questions and some advice for us. Sheila Heen and Douglas Stone are lecturers on law at Harvard and co-founders of Triad Consulting. Their new book is called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Sheila, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
And Doug, thanks a lot for joining us too.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So why should we think about feedback as a skill?
Well, that's a great question. So I think we usually think of it as just a thing that happens. We either get feedback or we don't, or we happen to be someone who's good at taking feedback, or we're a little more thin-skinned, and it's just the way we've always been in our life. And what Sheila and I figured out is that, in fact, however good you are at receiving feedback now, the sort of the way you showed up in the world, you can get better at it with some just some very specific tools and ways of thinking and ways of engaging in those conversations. So it's a skill in the sense that if you think about it, if you're reflective, if you practice a little bit, you can actually improve.
And Sheila, do we pay too much attention to how we give feedback and not enough to how we take it in?
Well, that is the usual focus of efforts in organizations in particular to try to improve conversations around performance or improve coaching that happens or improve performance appraisals, is that they put enormous time and resources into teaching managers how to give feedback more effectively. And that's helpful, but the bottom line is that if the receiver isn't able or willing to take in the feedback, there's really only so far skillfulness or even persistence are going to go. So we actually think we've had it backwards all these years, and that what we should be doing is actually all of us, and particularly people in leadership, learning how to receive more effectively and driving your own or accelerating your own learning.
Why should we be focusing so much on that instead of on the other end of the equation about the giving of the feedback? Because there are so many examples, and you give lots of them in your book, about feedback, which is just so completely hard to digest. Wouldn't it make it easier if people just got better at saying things nicely and well?
Yeah. Well, so that's exactly the point, is that there is so much challenging feedback out there that's not put poorly, it's not put skillfully, or it's put poorly, or it's mean, or it's nasty, or it's vague, or the person who gives it just, isn't that competent at giving feedback. And so what happens is if that's the focus, if we're moving through our life and we're kind of waiting for that perfect coach or that perfect teacher or perfect supervisor to show up who happens to be really good at it, we might be waiting an awfully long time. And the way that we can return leverage to ourselves is to say, look, whether the people around me are skilled or not at giving feedback, I'm going to get really good at figuring out, how to hear it, what can I actually learn from this, even if it's given, as poorly as could be.
Well, Sheila, let's start developing that skill now. What is the first step to take in learning to sift through whatever feedback is coming in and getting something good out of it?
Well, the first thing to do is don't decide right away whether the feedback is right or wrong. I think when someone tells you something, whether it's a quote-unquote suggestion for your parenting or in your performance evaluation you get your rating, we think that I have to decide, okay, is this right, which means I have to continue to worry about it, or can I find something wrong with it so then I can, relax, I can set it aside and move on. The problem is that feedback is usually delivered in these incredibly vague labels, like you need to be more proactive, or you need to work on your people skills, or you need to be more attentive to the kids. And those labels are so vague that it's not clear either what you've seen me do that leads you to think something needs to change, or what it is you want me to do differently. And in addition, we can always find something wrong with the feedback that we get. And so the goal is don't yet decide, but in addition to automatically reacting to what's wrong with the feedback, who gave it, how it's given, where it's given, et cetera, make a second list, which is also, is there anything that's right about this feedback? And have a more engaged conversation with the other person to actually try to understand what they're trying to tell you.
And it sounds as though from what you're saying, you know, one of the most important things toward receiving feedback well and is to try to pin the person down or maybe think about how to make it specific.
Yeah, you really want to ask follow-up questions. That's a huge part of this. And you want those questions to be aimed in a certain way. So you I think of it as being kind of two categories of questions. One is you want to know, where's this feedback coming from? What did, if it's your supervisor, what did my supervisor see? If they're talking about a meeting I was in, what did I say in that meeting that they observed that they're troubled by in some way? So I want to know what, look, sort of looking back, where the feedback comes from. And then looking forward, I want to think about, well, and where's this feedback going? In other words, what does my supervisor think I could be doing differently that would fix whatever was going on in the meeting?
Well, I will own up to doing some of what Sheila said and getting a little defensive when the feedback is coming in, looking maybe for a reason to dismiss it. In the book, you break down some triggers that kind of get our dander up and make us more likely to reject feedback, not take it for what it's worth. Sheila, can you run through briefly what those triggers are?
Yeah, absolutely. So what was interesting is that there are three reactions, sort of categories of reactions that we can have. One is the one that we've actually already been talking about, which is truth triggers. Is this right or is it wrong? And it's really hard to see whether it's right or wrong, not just because the giver is being vague, but also because we ourselves have blind spots. Or I should say you guys have blind spots. I know I don't have blind spots, of course, but everybody else in the world does. So it's actually quite challenging to see yourself accurately. The second set of triggers are what we call relationship triggers, and it's all based on who the giver is. And sometimes you would think that if the advice is either good or bad, it's either something we should follow or something we should reject, but in fact, who your giver is and your relationship and reactions to that person can mean that you reject the what because of the who. And then the third kind of trigger is what we call an identity trigger, and it has to do with your wiring. In terms of sensitivity to feedback, how far you swing, positive or negative, in the wake of feedback, and how long it takes you to recover, individuals can vary up to 3,000%. And so you have some people who are quite even keel, maybe even so even keel that feedback doesn't make much of an impression on them. It doesn't really get through. And other people who the same comment could have them reeling for, you know, a week. And when you are reeling, it can actually distort your sense of the feedback, so it grows, it sort of gets supersized. And one of our chapters really talks about how do you dismantle those distortions and understand your own patterns so that you can actually manage yourself in the wake of feedback.
Is it especially hard when you get feedback about something that you're incredibly invested in? Let's say you've spent 5 years of your life writing a novel, and you know, then you give it to someone to read, and anything they say that's not glowing, you know, you're going to have, you'll be in full turtle mode with your head pulled back in. How do you react and receive feedback when it's something that you care deeply about?
Yeah, and in many ways, that's the time that it's most important to be engaged with it. So receiving feedback well, it's not about not being upset or not having a normal human reaction. If you've, you know, invested 5 years of your life in something and then you get negative feedback, obviously that's going to be really disappointing. But as Sheila says, even when there's bad news, we tend to supersize it so that it becomes even more catastrophic than it might really be. And is there a way to keep it in perspective and to say, okay, so this is what the feedback means. This is what it doesn't mean. It's not about the next book that I write. It's about this one. And then the final piece of that is to always ask yourself, so what's the coaching here for me? There's some bad news here. Maybe the book that I spent so long on, maybe it won't get published, or you know, my friend's not going to like it. But in addition to that bad news, what's the coaching for me that where I can just get a little bit better next time?
Well, I think, can I add something to that?
Yeah, yeah.
Doug is pointing out, actually, that when we say the word feedback, that actually can mean three different kinds of things. It includes appreciation. An appreciation says, I see you, I get you, I value you, you matter. Coaching is aimed at helping you get better at something or to improve. And evaluation assesses you. It rates or ranks you. It tells you where you stand and what to expect. Obviously, that happens in appraisals at work, but also in relationships. You want to know, like, where do I stand? Where is this going from your point of view? If you're showing your book manuscript to the first human being you have allowed to see it, you need to be really clear with them what you need. And it could be that what you need to stay motivated right now is just appreciation. So you could just say, look, can you just tell me three things that you like about it?
So it's okay to do that?
I think it's okay to do that. First of all, you're saving your friend from doing a whole bunch of work that actually is not what you're looking for. It's actually not what would be helpful to you. And you'll get to a place where then you say to them, look, I just need some coaching. Like, does this chronology work? Or do you feel like you get to know the character? Or could you predict what was going to happen? So that you're very specific. Like, now what I need is I need some advice. Or you could say, I need an evaluation. I think it's ready to send to my whatever, publisher, agent, an editor, my father. Can you just look at it and tell me whether you think it's ready? And that is actually doing your givers a favor, because you're the one who knows what you need. You just need to think about it and be clear when you ask.
We're learning how to receive feedback and solicit feedback. Sheila Heen and Doug Stone are with us. Their new book is Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think is a key to giving, receiving good feedback? Can you share a piece of advice you've gotten from someone else that really helped you out, even if you didn't know it right away, or feedback maybe that stuck with you for the wrong reasons? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Doug Stone and Sheila Heen. They're the authors of Thanks for the Feedback. We're learning to take advice and criticism and to use it productively.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you good at taking feedback? Is there a piece of advice that made you change something about yourself? Do you have questions about how to take criticism from friends, family, bosses, and more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Polly on the line in Milwaukee. Polly, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. You were calling for examples about feedback and what was helpful.
Yeah.
One of the very best experiences I ever had was one of my teachers who helped me understand that feedback was a gift, and that in what I was doing, it was a professional gift, and so it looked and felt a little differently than other things. But so when I got feedback from an instructor or a colleague, I can now consider it receiving a gift. And if I give somebody something and ask for some feedback and I get nothing, I now feel like I haven't gotten a gift.
Polly, thanks so much for bringing that up. Sheila, what do you think of that idea? Should we all have that mindset that feedback is a gift?
I think that that's right. And Polly's attitude, I think, is part of what helps her hear it that way. And, you know, the often it can feel less like a gift and more like a colonoscopy when you are actually getting it, if it's painful. But one of the things that might help, Polly, to get something valuable from those who are a little reluctant is not to ask, hey, do you have any feedback for me? Because that's a really broad question. It's not clear how you want the person, you know, how honest they should be or what would be helpful to you. And we suggest actually asking for one thing. What's one thing you see me doing or failing to do where you think I'm getting in my own way? Or what's one thing I could change that would make a difference to you? And that actually will yield you something quite specific and concrete, and it's a much easier question for them to answer.
Well, thank you so much, Polly. And let's move along to Anthony in Madison. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, this is Anthony.
Hi, what do you think about feedback?
I'm actually an opera singer, and opera singers, it's our job to seek out advice from coaches and teachers on a weekly basis. And my advice is to separate what it is you're asking people to give advice for. So for me, it's my voice. When they're critiquing my voice, they're not critiquing me as a person. They're just critiquing my art form, and they're actually asking me to get better at that. And so it really helps to separate those two.
All right, that's a great way to think about it, Anthony. And he's sort of getting at the idea that maybe the feedback someone is getting, it's not a moratorium on whether or not you're a decent human being. It's just directed at a skill. Is that a good way to think about it?
Exactly. That's that distinction between evaluation and coaching. Anthony's hearing it as coaching. This is going to help me get better. And, of course, any kind of coaching that you get that helps you get better is going to be a good thing. Whereas evaluation, you know, this is how good you are right now, or you're never going to be better. It's a rating, can be very threatening. You know, opera singers are a particularly interesting case for feedback because in our research for this book, we found out that people hear other people's voices through a particular part of the brain that analyzes the sort of the tone and the emotional content of what the person's saying. But when we ourselves are speaking, that part of our brain actually shuts down. And so we don't hear ourselves when we speak or when we sing the way that everyone else in the world hears us. And this is why for singers and performers, having that sort of external pair of ears is so incredibly important.
Or radio hosts, I imagine.
Or radio hosts, exactly.
As we near annual evaluation time at Wisconsin Public Radio. Anthony, thanks for the call. We've got Grace with us now in New Glarus. Grace, hi.
Hi, how are you folks doing today?
Good. What do you think about feedback?
Well, a couple of things. I definitely agree with Anthony on you really have to separate that the person giving you feedback is not giving you feedback on you as a human being. It is on your skill, your work product, perhaps your attitude if it's a like dealing with customers or something. I experienced very young that sort of thing because I rode horses for a long time. And when you are taking lessons and receiving input from your coach, it is designed to make you a better rider. And I became a teacher, a riding teacher, and a horse trainer. I moved into scientific field. When you submit a paper, it's the paper that's being critiqued, not you as a human. The other thing is don't ask for feedback from someone in a very emotionally charged situation. Mm. If you're angry at the person, or even if you're angry at someone else, or if you're in a really down mood for whatever reason, that's not the best time to receive a critique.
Interesting. Grace, thanks a lot for that. And Sheila, is that a good advice to try to keep those moments of feedback separated from those moments of emotion?
I do think Grace is onto something in terms of knowing when you actually have the capacity to take in feedback. And her earlier advice about trying to separate you as a person from the skill or the task that you are trying to get better at is really good advice, and the place where that's actually the hardest is inside relationships, right? With you, when your spouse has complaints about you, they're giving you feedback, although, you know, you think of it less as feedback and more as them being annoying. and it's one of the reasons for two things that it's really hard to take what we call relationship coaching, where there's something going on that the other person really wants you to change. It's hard not to feel that as an attack. And second, it's probably one of the reasons why the marriage research by John Gottman up in Seattle shows that a spouse's ability to hear coaching or complaints from their spouse and be influenced by them is one of the key predictors of a happy, successful marriage.
Interesting. Are there ever any pieces of feedback that you can just uniformly throw out if someone really does seem to be full of it and not saying anything that's constructive? Or is there really a kernel, a gift, a pearl in all feedback?
Interestingly, I think social media, and maybe the two of you being in the media have personal experiences of this, social media, it's created a whole milieu of a situation where you really can ask the question, you know, is this really feedback? Is there something for me to learn from this, or is this just some game that people are playing and it's got a set of rules that really has nothing to do with me? And I think when we get that those crazy comments that are just seem sort of out of bounds, or someone is venting, or they're trying to entertain their friends, or it feels like it's just their thing that they have to get off their chest, has nothing to do with this. I think in those situations, it's pretty reasonable to say, you know what, this really just isn't about me. It's the, you know, the person just needed to say that about something or someone, and so they did. I think it's okay to decide that this really doesn't apply to me.
Sheila, one piece of advice to leave us with, if you would, for the next time we're in a situation where we're getting feedback and maybe starting to feel the defenses, the shields going up.
Well, one would be just not to respond right away and to ask as many questions as you can and then let them know, you know, I need to think about this a little bit. So you can buy yourself some time. You know, I think that so often we think we have to respond in the moment and handle it perfectly in the moment, when in fact, you know, this process is a lifelong process. And also, the more you take initiative, the more control you have. The research also shows that people who seek out negative feedback, meaning they're not just fishing for compliments, they're looking for things they can improve, are not only more satisfied at work and adapt more quickly to new roles, but they also have higher performance reviews. So sometimes actually taking the bull by the horns is a way to choose your moments where you're most receptive, and then also not do anything that actually does harm when you get ambushed by it, of course.
All right, Sheila, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Doug, thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Sheila Heen and Doug Stone about their new book, Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well.